Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
John Bishop, how are you doing?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Yeah,
thanks
pretty
for having
good.
Me.
This is a sports show, it's a football show. You like your football?
Occasionally, yeah.
It had a life-changing effect on you, right?
It's had many life-changing effects on me, but if you're referring to Istanbul, that was a main contributing factor to the reason that I left my job.
You had a ticket for Istanbul, but you didn't make it to the game.
No, what happened was I had the ticket because I'd been to all the group games at Anfield, and then I had the job. I was working for a pharmaceutical company, and the boss said, you can't. We had a big conference going on in Seattle, and he said, you can't not go. You've got to go. And I had to host a meeting that like would have been the day before, and with the time difference, I was trying to work out if I could fly the other way. And you could, there was a change you could do in Tokyo that would have got me there, landing in Istanbul at half time. And I thought, that's not weird, is it? So what I did is, but I could get home to my house. So I could get up back to my house in time. And I literally flew, I'll never forget it, I flew from Seattle, got back to my house after travelling for like, I think it was something ridiculous, like 19 hours, walked into my front door as they were kicking off, but all my mates had gone the game. So they'd sent all their wives and kids to my house. So I was in a house full of people not bothered. So I'm sat there with girls doing cartwheels in front of the telly while my mates were at the match. And at half time, I thought, I've made a good decision. You know what I mean? And then at the end, and I was walking the streets because I had jet lag. My mates were phoning me because they were at the airport where they were all stuck in Istanbul. And I thought, never again is someone going to tell me what I can do. So I decided to leave my job.
And by that stage, had you already decided that comedy was the thing that you were going to make it as a comedian?
I was doing stand-up then. I'd been doing it for 5 years, but I was doing it around the clubs. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't making a break in telly. I wasn't sure it would lead to anything, but I just knew I couldn't be told I can't go to a game like that again.
Yeah. Maybe in retrospect, if you had actually gone and made it at halftime, if you'd flown through Tokyo, your life would have taken a different path, but you would have been at the greatest game of all time.
Exactly. Exactly.
So would you swap it all?
I think I made the right choice. I think, yeah, the way the stars aligned, it was the right way things should fall.
What was going through your head then during the second half as Liverpool are conjuring up this remarkable comeback? Are you enjoying it the way a Liverpool supporter would?
I was. You know what? And I'm not kidding you. This is going to sound dramatic. It probably took me, and my wife had confirmed, it took me about 3 years to get over it. I really was, any time it was mentioned, I was, and I ended up, I did a play called One Night in Istanbul in Liverpool, which was all about it. And in the play, my character, just as it happens, doesn't get to the game either because I ended up getting kidnapped by this girl, and so I'm strapped to the seat and I negotiate with my kidnappers that I can watch it on a telly, and as they're threatening me, all I'm bothered about is the game. That was the first time I'd watched the penalties, because I couldn't watch the penalties on the time. I was so stressed and intense, I couldn't watch it. I was in the garden when the penalties happened, so it was 3 years after when the play happened that I watched it.
We had a situation with this radio show where last November Ireland beat the All Blacks in Chicago. Our greatest ever rugby victory, and for various reasons half the team went and half the team had to stay.
Yeah.
And they haven't let those of us who stayed live it down ever since.
It was amazing. It was the best weekend of all time. We got treated like royalty from the second week.
No, it was the best weekend so far. That's the way I've done it. That's what my mate said to me, it's the best week. Because I was then there when we won the FA Cup. It's West Ham, so I was there for that. And so you go, all right, it's a little bit like it. It's not like it, but it's a little bit like it. You know what I mean? So from my point of view, I think I'm just hanging on for that moment. And you'd be the same. You know, they can go on about it, but there's a better weekend around the corner.
When?
But they're not going to be here.
Ever so far away, it's coming. There's a good time coming.
Probably the week after they die. That's the way I'm thinking of it. As long as I live longer than me mates who went, yeah. I'm going to be going, you're going to miss it. There's a great weekend coming, but you're not going to see it.
Was it easy enough to get out of being a guy who worked in the pharmaceutical industry into, like, when you make that decision that next day or whenever you kind of finally come down and go, hang on, that's never happened to me again. Is it a straightforward thing?
No, what happened is it took, because as I say, I was doing a bit of stand-up anyway, and it was about a month, and I was just proper miserable. And then talking to me, well, she said, just do something else. And I wasn't sure the stand-up was a job. I just wasn't sure it would lead to anything. But I'd been on the circuit with people like Jimmy Carr and Alan Carr, and they were already popping up on telly. And I thought, and I was starting to get sportsmen's dinners and stuff like that. And she was brilliant, Melanie. I mean, we had mortgage, three kids, I had a good job. And she just said, look, there's no point you walk around being miserable. Sort it out.
Yeah.
So I just worked out that if I did the circuit, got a few more gigs on the circuit, did a sportsman's dinner every couple of weeks, I kind of covered the bills. That's all I was after.
And were you any good at that stage?
I was ace. No, I mean, I was... But did you... You know what the truth is? Anyone who does comedy would say this. Comedy, you can't cheat comedy. Even if you're on a stage in front of a room full of strangers and you say something and they laugh, you're funny. That's it. You're officially funny. Some people might go, oh, that was obvious, or I didn't like that brand of humour, but they can't say you're not funny because those people laughed because it's like instant, isn't it? It's instant communication. So you don't think you're laughing. You laugh or you don't.
Yeah.
And so what happens in comedy, you come into it, and if you're good, people start... It's so welcoming. All comedians support other comedians who are good and push it on, and you end up being the headline act on the circuit. And no one can argue with it because you're the one making more people laugh. It's just the way it works.
And the amount of time that it takes you to get an act good, like you hear about people kind of... workshop in an act over a long period of time. You had a full-time job and three kids, so it can't have been that easy to constantly...
Oh, listen, I did my first open spot in October 2000, and I did my... So that's the first time I ever walked on a stage, and I did my first deadline spot in January.
Right.
And that was quick. That was quick, but I didn't know it was quick. And it wasn't like I was a good headline. It was just that I got booked. But I didn't, because I knew no one who did it, and I had no interest in it, and I never went to comedy clubs. I didn't know that that was unusual. I just thought that's what happened. And it was only when I decided that I was going to leave the job, I actually concentrated on it and found that you could get better and you could do other things. Prior to that, I literally just rock up because it was a bit of spare cash.
That sounds pretty good and unusual.
Yeah.
And the,
it ended the interview then, though, didn't it?
do you ever miss part of that? Because, like, you're coming back to Dublin in October.
Yeah.
It's Three Arena. It's 7, 8, 9, maybe even 10,000 people.
Yeah, yeah.
You're not exactly getting to look people in the whites of their eyes when you're telling the jokes.
But prior to that, I'm off. I'm going to, like, you know, Ennis, and I'm going to Dolan's and Limerick and stuff like that. So, I'm doing like warm-up gigs, and I'll be honest, I am loving them. And they're in sort of theatres up to 1,000, and I'm really loving them. If someone said, that's it, that's all you can ever do again, I'd be very happy. But what I've been doing when I've been coming to Ireland, because of time and everything else, I've ended up, you know, in the north, I've just done the arena in Belfast, and in the south, I've done the Three Arena, and occasionally I've done Cork Opera House. So this time I said, look, I want to do other places. So and hopefully this will be the start of me going around doing all the other places, because the likes of, you know, Tommy Tiernan and Jason Byrne, people like that, you talk to them, some of the venues that they do is great.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the international?
Oh, yeah, I've done the international a few times, yeah.
Because I remember when Tommy Tiernan was workshopping there one night, he came out and he had no, it was a fiver in, so like nobody...
Yeah.
And he actually had notes written down. He didn't look at them, but they were there for him, because it was at that stage of... He was building an hour, and obviously he only did 20, 25 yeah. minutes. How do you build an hour for somewhere like an arena?
Well, what I do right now, the problem that I've got is I don't write it down because it never looks funny. Do you know what I mean? I look and go, that's not funny. It's got to live with me. So I just go, well, I've got them all on my phone, actually. I do all these warm-up gigs like I've been doing. I mean, so manager records them.
Ah, right.
Because I'll go off on tangents and I don't, when I do a warm up tour, I don't have an interval. So I'll do like an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes, just basically letting it all fall together. And then I listen back to him, but I don't like listening to myself. And it takes too long. I don't want to listen to an hour and a half of myself. So he's recorded them in double speed. And honest to God, I sound, literally, I sound like Jamie Carragher on crack. It's just, it's ridiculous. So
is everything not funny in double speed?
You know, I'm thinking of just playing it.
I was thinking everything must be funny in double speed.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Scouse Chipmunk. So let's go back to the football, right? Because like your relationship with Liverpool Football Club is, it's a real thing. It's something that you've kind of, has been a part of your life forever. Yeah. And obviously the last couple of weeks, we've finally seen a little bit of the beginning of closure for the people of Liverpool after what happened at Hillsborough. And, you know, I wonder if you and comedy in that city and how it deals with tragedy is something that is a very important thing. Like, I don't know how the city has managed to survive the way it did, because there's the terrible tragedy of what happens, and then there's the grotesqueness of the institutions coming around and saying, no, you're wrong, you know, you're responsible for this in your own way. And there's never a possibility for the people to grieve properly. There's never any support network for them. And yet there is loads of comedians from Liverpool who, and there's a real solidarity among the people. And I don't know, I'm just really interested in your take on how the city survived and why
well,
it survived.
Look, I mean, I can't comment for the families and what they've been through. You know, I can only talk about it from my perspective, seeing it from a fan. Obviously, I know a number of them, and I've been involved with the campaigns, both, you know, publicly and privately. And it's heartbreaking to imagine, as you said, that there was such institutional failure. If, you know, we're football supporters, and you've got to remember at the time when it happened, there was the Thatcher government, there was the idea that, you know, standing on the terraces and the hooliganism and the fences and all the rest of it that existed, only existed because football supporters were regarded as less worthy than other sports. If that event, if that thing had have happened at an international rugby match at Twickenham, there's no way it would have took 28 years to find somebody potentially responsible. At the moment, you know, people are getting charged, and what the families want, what everyone wants, is accountability. It's took enormous tenacity and bravery for them to keep on going, where everybody, and I mean successive governments, you know, Labour and Conservative, have just been saying, oh, come on, you've made your noise, but just let's brush it under the carpet. That's an insult to basic humanity. And I think it says a lot about them as people that have done it. You know, the families and the survivors are now getting some sense of I guess I should imagine, some degree of resolution. But it'll never be fully resolved. You'll never get closure on it. And unfortunately, some people have not lived long enough to see the start of this process. And that's what's heartbreaking. It was so obvious, because what's going to happen now will not be new. No one suddenly turned a stone and found new evidence. Mm. It's been there from day one.
That's the worst part about it. But I don't know how the city kept going. I don't know how the fans kept going. I don't know how the organisation, like the Justice for the 96, kept going, because it seemed like every time they were making a bit of progress, it got shut down.
Yeah, yeah, and that's what I mean. You've got to have such, I suppose, a great sense of justice, but also now it's in the public eye, and the last I suppose in some respects, when Liverpool became the European capital of culture, you know, there's a new Lord Mayor there, Steve Rotherham, who said, right, I want to make this, whilst all the eyes of the world are on us, I want to make this something that we try and resolve. And then obviously there was that thing where Andy Burnham came to the celebration, he was the, you know, the Labour sports minister, and people said, you're not listening. And he said, right, we'll start it again. But that shouldn't have ever reached that point. And I think from a city's point of view, it says a lot about the city, because I think there's such a community spirit within Liverpool. But I don't think there's anything to be gained by saying, oh, this is a battle that was won uniquely because it was Liverpool, because it was that. It was fathers, brothers, sisters, daughters, mothers, they were the people who have won. And that bond that you have for your family is universal. And the injustice that they had to suffer for so long is palpable. Everyone can imagine it and feel it.
I know you say it, we shouldn't, but it does feel like from the outside that there are a lot of cities that actually wouldn't have had the staying power or the tenacity.
I think you're probably right, yeah. I think you're probably right. And, you know, the reason that I said that it shouldn't be seen as just the Liverpool thing is because there's a universality to that experience. And that was one of the things I think. You don't want to end up with a chip on your shoulder, but the reality is, I think if it hadn't have been Liverpool, it may be, you know, and God forbid, it'd have been Tottenham.
Yeah.
I don't think the Thatcher government would have adopted the same attitude.
I think that's probably the other point, isn't it? It's that it did kind of feed into that whole sense of actually, hang on, they're able to do this to us because actually we haven't been represented properly for a long period of time.
And, you know, there was a political agenda at the time to disassociate the north of England with the rest of England.
And to dehumanise the working classes because ultimately, that, and we see where that leads to.
Exactly. Grenfell didn't just happen overnight, did it?
Yeah. Do you feel, as somebody with a public forum, that there's a responsibility on you to address these things all the time? Or do you feel it's the other side?
And it's really, really difficult. Really difficult. Because we've just had a recent election in England. And, you know, if you're going to address something like that, you've got to try and do it properly. Like, I've sent out the odd tweet and then people respond and you go, oh, you know, 146 characters isn't a way to address this complicated issue. And you say, okay, well, you've got a public forum. Well, that public forum might lead you to say, right, I want to say something about, you know, social housing and the way it's been managed. I want to say something about the education system. I want to say something about mental health. And then people go, hang on, I lived with all of that. I've come into this room with you so that you can make me laugh and I can spend a couple of hours not having to worry about that. I need to be cheered up.
Yeah.
I don't need to be told what's wrong.
It's a balancing
act,
right?
It's a balancing act. So the way I treat my stand-up is that's my opportunity to tickle people. It's my opportunity to say, look, let's have a laugh. We're in this together. I don't regard me being a stand-up as me going, right, whilst you're all in it, I'm going to educate you. I'm not. I'm going to try and make you laugh.
Yeah.
But outside of that, it's increasingly something that I face a little bit of conflict with myself, is that I do a number of things privately, but you almost feel you've got a platform that you could address it. But in doing that, you might reduce people's, I don't know, the gain that they get from the other part of your life.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
I
It's a difficult. Well, to be honest, I wasn't expecting that as a question, but within this forum, you know, on a talk radio station or something like that, you have a space to do it. If as a comedian, I do an interview with a print journalist, I haven't always got control of what they put in of that interview. You haven't always got control of the edit, and then next thing you know, your words have been taken out of context. So I think it's a brilliant thing to do, but you've got to control the environment that it's done in.
Yeah. Is that actually part of your evolution of your career as well? That actually you get to a point in your life where you're more comfortable having those conversations. Also, like, you're making a move into serious acting as well.
Yeah.
Maybe it's not a move if you were already doing One Night in Istanbul. Like, that was always part of...
Yeah, One Night in Istanbul wasn't serious. It was just fun. It was great fun.
But it is a sense that, like, okay, you've mastered an art and you get to, okay, I don't know, no one ever gets complacent about comedy because the next gig they might stop laughing and that's always a drive. But there is this sense that you reach a point in your life where you're like, I kind of feel like I need to say some stuff and I need to try some other things and there's other parts of my brain I want to work.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, that's never been... Like, I've always been quite politically active anyway, but under the radar, and what happened, interestingly, where I live, George Osborne, you know, the Conservative ex-chancellor, his constituency's next door, and he gave it up to go and be the editor of the Evening Standard. And I had a very serious 7-minute conversation with my wife, because I said, look, do you think I should stand? I could get in touch with the Labour Party, maybe stand as a Labour candidate for Parliament. And she went, right, now let's sit down. First of all, what does an MP get paid? Secondly, she said, yo, they'll pour over everything in your life. And you're not just you, because we've got kids and they're setting out their stall in their life. She said, you know, maybe not just yet, you could do other things. And like always, she was right.
Once that kind of runs down the back of your head, though, it's impossible to shake it, right?
Oh, it is. It is impossible to shake it. And what you got to do is to say, all right, then, well, I'll try and do what I can that's responsible.
Yeah.
But also, you know, as you said, you get to a point in your life where you want to make a bit more of a contribution, but you should never underestimate the contribution that you're making by the job that you do.
No, absolutely. Everybody takes the stuff that they do for granted. Like,
yeah.
Particularly when it's entertainment, because we don't, stupidly as a society, don't value it as much as we should.
Yeah.
Like the ability to get a large group of people together laughing is an unbelievable thing. It's like football.
It is one of those things. I remember reading the Soccer Tribe, Desmond Morris, I don't even remember him. I think he was an anthropologist, and he wrote about football as an anthropologist. And the first paragraph of it, he said, you know, if an alien was to invade Earth on a Saturday afternoon at 3 o'clock, they'd be thinking this was a wondrous religious event, or they'd be wondering whether this is how our nations settle disputes, because the passion involved is beyond the word game.
Yeah.
And it's true, isn't it? You as a society, we sometimes undervalue what's closest to us for what it does. And I think, you know, you've got to keep on focusing on the fact that there's a value to music, there's a value to broadcast, there's a value to comedy, there's a value to film that doesn't always say we're going to fix it. It just says, look, let's for now enjoy being us.
And it's not always an economic value or an economic input into the society that we can measure and a balance sheet.
Yeah, yeah.
Everything gets reduced to the cash at the end, and
that's what's wrong. I think what we're missing without getting too heavy on things is like happiness. You know, in the UK, there's loads of things about the mental health scales of people, and we in the West are not as happy as we would expect to be.
A lot of people, if they were saying that, I'd be like, you know, blah, 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 you're saying this. But you actually obviously had a job that was making you a bit miserable. And so you did say, okay, I have to do something to find myself.
Yeah.
And you didn't do it as a 19 or 21-year-old. You did it with 3 kids.
I was 40 when I left my job. Like 40?
I'm 40 now.
That's bonkers.
Off you go.
Yeah. There's a job in the pharmaceutical industry.
It is bonkers.
Yeah. But I'm obviously glad I did it.
Yeah. Did you know it was going to work?
Oh, yeah.
You did?
Of course I didn't know. No, seriously. The first 2 years that I left my job, I didn't earn as much money as I did when I was in my job. And I had to put money onto the mortgage. I was struggling. I was kind of lying to me missus that it was all going to turn out.
And so what was your mental health like at that point?
All right, because I've never been that materialistic. I've never been ambitious to own things. I've just been ambitious to try and be happier as a person. But my big concern was whether things would be all right with the kids and stuff. You know, because we had the kids then were, you know, 12, 11, you know what I mean? You're at a time where they need some stability, and I'm thinking, God, am I going to have to sell the house?
Yeah, daddy doesn't have a job anymore.
Daddy doesn't have a job.
But he's funny.
Yeah, he gets away with it. But fortunately, there was a turn. And it's gone. Oh, it's gone beyond anything I would have thought.
Yeah.
Massively beyond it, but
if you're doing the acting now, is that next? Is that like you're going to do that and give it a couple of years?
Stand up. Everything is right. I do the acting. I do this interview show, which I love. This In Conversation on the W Channel, which is I absolutely love that. But stand up is the thing that I'll be doing last. You know, I'll be doing stand up for a lot longer than people want me to.
The In Conversation show is actually a show that started on Liverpool TV, right? You asked that with
It's a good show, actually. Yeah, I had the thing on LFC TV where I was interviewing ex-players. And that was the start of it, the idea that you could do it. And obviously, when you're a fan and you talk to somebody like Robbie Fowler, it's like, that's not hard. But I always wanted to do that type of show, do an interview. You know, like this, like we're having an interview now, but we're having a chat, aren't we? There was no microphones here.
Yeah.
And you didn't have headphones on and we weren't in the studio. The conversation would be no different. And I think sometimes that gets lost in telly particularly because you just want chat. You want,
yeah.
Tell us your funny bit and then move on.
Give us a soundbite.
Yeah.
I'm going to set this joke up. You're going to hit it out and then we'll go on to the next bit. And then there's an ad break in between for longer than we've actually been on TV.
Yeah.
You were talking there about aliens landing in at 3 o'clock on a Saturday and landing in a football match and what they'd make of it. When you go to football matches now and you go to Anfield now, do you feel that that is still the same feeling that's there for,
well, for
Liverpool
start,
supporters
for
compared
start,
to 20 years ago?
And if, the supporters from Ireland are the ones I feel most sorry for because I've got mates who make the arrangements, book the flight, get the hotel, get the tickets, and they go, oh, we're moving it now to Monday night. And you go, Jesus! You know what I mean? And they tell you like a week or so before, and that does my head in. So I think personally, football's changed dramatically in terms of the atmosphere that used to get in the ground. And if you were to take all the things that they say is the best league and all the rest of it, and it shouldn't cost so much at all to go to a game. You know, your working man should be able to take his kids to the match. Not like, you know, once a season.
Yeah.
The cost is ridiculous. And I think also this idea of becoming a slave to telly is a real difficulty. But I don't think there's any way back from it.
It definitely seems to me from going to Anfield from, say, 10 years ago, but particularly been there a lot this year, it is dead, and maybe it's because of the new stand, but it feels as though that basic supporter base has been sort of pushed out. And you don't want to criticise people who are, as you say, spending a huge amount of money to go over for the day, and it's the one time they go there all season, but it's just a trip around. You look at the stadium and the match is just sort of part of that.
No, exactly. And also, and this is going to sound bonkers, but like the players, right, we're signing players. You can't get a song for them. You can't spell after names. You know what I mean? There's not that affection, is there? So when you get, as you go, you go and they go, okay, how many plays have we got actual songs for? You know, Adam Lallana is good. You can make a song out of that. But it doesn't always work with everyone. And you also, what used to happen 10, 15, 20 years ago, everyone in the ground was four steps removed from everyone on the pitch. So everyone knew someone whose cousin knew the girlfriend of the player who was playing because they went to school with them.
Yeah.
Gone now. They just get zipped in from somewhere on another planet or Southampton, zipped in, and they play and then they go out. And I think that is, I personally don't like the amount of foreign players that we've got because, not because there's anything wrong with them, it's because if you had a foreign player like at Anfield, you know, we had Jan Mobley, you know, Arsenal, Dennis Bergkamp, you know, you'd get somebody who'd go, wow, now we sign foreign players who, in all honesty, are not that much better.
Mediocre sub-left backs for
exactly.
12, 14 million.
Why are we doing that? That's killing it because it removes your passion as Liverpool supporters. You know, Cara, Steven Gerrard, there's someone on the pitch who represents it being from Liverpool. Yeah, well, a foreign player used to be someone from Scotland. Now if someone from Scotland's playing, you can't believe it.
Yeah, it doesn't happen that much. You were a reasonable footballer yourself. You played to a reasonable level.
Honest to God, the scouting system failed me. How did it miss me? I don't know.
You did actually play, though. You were like, was it Southend? Not Southend. What was it?
Southport.
Southport, sorry.
I played in what was the conference, the Vauxhall conference, and then, but mainly I played in the Northern Premier League, which was the level below that. So in the pyramid system, we were, two leagues below the league, really.
You played in some of them big charity games, haven't you? The ones they show live on Sky.
Oh, unbelievable.
Where Jose Mourinho's your manager.
Yeah. Soccer Aid, brilliant. Just talking about it before, I mean, of all the side effects of, I suppose, getting famous or doing this job, that is the best side effect by a gazillion miles. Because you'd have a week. I mean, anyone listening to this who loves football, You have a week pretending you're a footballer. They take you down to London. You stay in a hotel. You get a tracksuit to wear that you're all wearing the same tracksuit. And you go and train every day at Fulham's ground. And you do that from the Tuesday night right through. And then you get a bus up on Saturday to Old Trafford. And then you play in front of 70,000 people. It's unbelievable. But you know what's good? It's for charity. And if that, you know, if I can help the kids by doing that. You know, there's little kids in Africa who every year they, oh God, I hope Bish plays again. That'll help pay to take me to school. And I'm just like that. I'll just do it for them.
What a giver.
Who was on your team? Was it Mourinho was your manager or was it?
Yeah, what happened this time? Mourinho was the rest of the world manager last time. And day one, and then he said he wanted to do Soccer Aid again but be manager of England. And then he got the job at United, so United said he couldn't do it because that would be his first game at Old Trafford. And then there was a bit of squabbling and Sam Allardyce became the manager and he became like the director of football. So it was a bit ridiculous really, but he was involved to an extent. It was mainly Sam. Mourinho got involved towards the end and was in the dressing room and stuff. But players-wise, I mean, it was like, oh God, who played with us? So I think Sol Campbell, Dave Seaman, Jamie Carragher, Jermaine Defoe. Jermaine Defoe was our sub. How great is that?
Just signed a 3-year deal.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Literally, because Sam Allardyce was the manager of Sunderland at the time, and Jermaine was on holiday, and he said, "Look, if you want a new deal, you've got to come and play for Soccer Aid.
Wow,
do 20 minutes."
But you're playing against Clarence Seedorf and Edgar Davids,
yeah,
bearing down on you.
Ronaldinho. I mean, it's just ridiculous.
Ronaldinho enjoys himself. Do you get to go out with him afterwards? Is there like a Ronaldinho?
Yeah, well, what
entourage?
We do is because you're there for the period of time that you're there, and so you stay in the hotel and you're all socialising. To be fair, the likes of Nicky Byrne and stuff and Niall Horan, who were on the rest of the world, they're desperate to get in the England camp because we treat it like a stag do. It's just brilliant. Whereas there with like, you know, some Hollywood actor, you go, whoa. But so then, so we have those few days and then we have a big do on the night after the game on the Sunday.
And that sounds pretty good.
Oh, beyond good. Literally, lads, it's beyond good.
Needs a radio partner.
Every time, I am literally anger on because I was the oldest player on the pitch last year. I'm literally anger on to get involved again. And every time I do, because the game's on a Sunday and I wake up on the Monday and if somebody has said, that's it, now your career's over, go fine. That'll do. I'll go back to the pharmaceutical sales.
On that note, John, it's been brilliant having you in. Thanks a million.
Thanks for having me, boys. Thank you.
Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.